To order, it's January.
It is January.
It's January 24th today. And we're going to go ahead, since we have a quorum, we're going to go ahead and start an informational meeting on the Emerging Business Program. And our presenters are Matt Garrett and Michael Cobb.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. And with me is Michael Cobb. Michael's the manager of the Office of Civil Rights. I'm kind of cutting in on Michael's time here, and I apologize, but this is something very important to me. And I thought I'd share some thoughts initially about where we're going as an agency. Representative Smith, and the first time I had a chance to speak with you, mentioned some of the good work that we're doing in this area. And I completely subscribe to that. We are aggressively turning our attention to the opportunities and promoting and trying to remove some obstacles so we can actually provide opportunities for all Oregonians in the transportation world. So it is a privilege for me to speak to the workforce development plan we have underway, some of the small business initiatives encapsulated by work with disadvantaged businesses and emerging small businesses. The story really begins with the Oregon Transportation Investment Act number 3. With the mandates of project delivery, there were more mandates embedded in that investment package. One significant mandate was to grow a qualified and diverse workforce in the construction trades. So, for all intents and purposes, OTIA 3 brought both the supply in that we will have jobs, in that we will have projects, and the demand for labor, jobs. We need the horses to help us pull this investment package forward. So ODOT engaged in the development of a workforce development plan, a plan that had an articulated hard goals that would go into our contract specific to disadvantaged businesses, as well as an effort to increase apprenticeships, rising from 5% on a glide path that eventually plateaued at about 20%, a very aggressive agenda. Now, this was in a context of a challenging environment. There are issues of trust. There is a history of doing business. There is a history of running many races and not crossing the finish line and trying to promote opportunities for small, emerging, minority-type businesses. We are a big, complex business at ODOT, so there's a little bit of a history that we had to engage in as we continued to build this workforce plan. What we did as an agency, recognizing the context that we were in, we could no longer have independent conversations. We needed to have an aggressive engagement. So we brought together the apparatus of state government, ODOT, the Employment Division, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, Education, the community colleges, Portland Community College Skills Centers. We took that apparatus and positioned it to better inform the overall conversation. What could we do as a state agency to help promote and grow a healthy environment in this direction? In addition to the state apparatus, we brought in the community-based organizations. Those folks are already on the ground doing this work. They were the apparatus of providing opportunities, access for people, and training and such, preparing them to move into the construction trades. We knew as we entered this conversation that we weren't going to recreate the wheel. That was one of the failures of the past. We came in saying this is an opportunity and we'll complement the existing structures that exist out there. The third leg of the stool was labor, the contracting community, significant folks, the folks who are there, who become the arms and the legs to deliver this thing. We knew if we brought these folks around the table and formed what Michael will speak to in a little bit, workforce alliances, to identify some of the challenges, to help identify where there are folks who have the skill sets to move quickly into apprenticeships, or where there are folks that need a little bit of training and they need to plug in or access this conversation at a different level. And looking at the whole of the continuum, where do we make the investments to optimize that opportunity to allow folks access to the construction trades. And in turn, I think a benefit for my agency, also expose them to the Oregon Department of Transportation and the breadth and depth of activities we do. So again, not only am I trying to promote and grow a diverse and qualified workforce for the private sector, I'm also looking to take advantage of it for my agency because I can become a healthier agency with those different perspectives informing my decisions. So we started to engage very aggressively on that front, and then a decision from the Ninth Circuit Court came in, calling the question on our hard goals specific to the disadvantaged business enterprise. The court, for all intents and purposes, ruled that you hadn't done the foundational work. There wasn't a disparity study that showed there wasn't an even playing ground for all people. Some people may have been discriminated against, to put it simply. Before you can have those hard targets, you have to inform that discussion. You must engage in a disparity study to inform that. And we have. We're engaged right now in about a year-long process. We just brought some folks on that have immense experience with other states to help pursue this pathway to inform the overall discussion and direction we had. But that said, with that ruling from the Ninth Circuit, it called into question our hard goals. So we had to move from hard goals that would have been placed into the contracts to more aspirational goals. We still want to be aggressive. We still want to grow a diverse workforce here. We just have a little bit of work to do on the disadvantaged business enterprise side to inform this, and our disparity study will indeed do just that. It's a key piece of information that, again, better informs the overall direction. So that's the workforce development side. Turn the page over, and there's another aggressive effort underway, clothed in the garment of small business opportunities. Again, focusing on disadvantaged emerging small business. Really what it comes down to, are there barriers and obstacles placed in front of these types of individuals that deny them access to opportunity? Has my agency put any of these barriers in the way? I've called these folks around the table. Again, small business not being a monolith, but being made up of several different components, bringing in the minority business people, the women-owned business people, the folks just getting started that think, hey, I'd like to play in the transportation world. I think there's some opportunity there. We brought them together, and again, rather than having individual conversations with each of these groups, we said, come around the table with us, and come around the table with the Associated General Contractors as well. Again, this three-legged stool will help inform the issues, the challenges, and if indeed there exist barriers that my agency may have put in a pathway, we will find remedies to remove those. So whether it's procurement, whether it's insurance, whether it's just creating the healthiest environment for these folks, I think I have the right people now sitting around the table rather than having the independent conversations that we once had, where we could indeed talk past each other. I think that's a positive move. Another move I made, one of the first things I did, because this is important to me, as I said at the beginning, is I moved the Office of Civil Rights into the director's office. I think this is not only symbolic to some sense, but it is a significant move. I need to institutionalize this type of approach, this type of attitude, because I will come and go. That's just the fact of life. But I want to make sure the way ODOT does business offers opportunity for all Oregonians to compete in the transportation world. So let me close, Madam Chair, by saying that initially this pursuit was a mandate coming from you and your colleagues. But I would say we take this on not because of the mandate or the legislative direction you've given us. We take this on because it's a good business decision. It is good for us now, and you look at the demographics of the state, it's going to be good business for us into the future. So, Madam Chair, that concludes my remarks. I'm happy to take any questions, or I can turn it over to Michael, who will dig down into this this issue a little deeper.
Are there any questions? All right. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Michael Cobb. I'm the manager of the Office of Civil Rights for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And before I begin, I'd just like to preface things by saying this whole effort that ODOT has undertaken is really about change. And one of the most significant things that we could have done was by Director Garrett taking the move to place the Office of Civil Rights within the director's office, because it sends a message that he is not only professionally committed, the agency is committed, he's personally committed. And it set a stage here that is telling everyone that this is indeed important to ODOT. So in moving forward on these initiatives, you know, ODOT realized early on that in order to truly stimulate the Oregon economy, several things had to be done. We had to do more than simply find jobs for people, but we actually had to find long-term sustainable careers. So everything that we're looking at here is gauging towards developing folks for long-term sustainable careers. Studies told us that starting later this year and in 2008, there would be a significant decline in the available workforce in the state of Oregon. Knowing that, along with the number of projects and the aggressive schedules we have in the OTIA 3 construction programs, we say, well, how then, if we're losing people to the workforce, how are we going to have enough people to do the work when the time comes? And we had many meetings with the construction community, and contractors were saying the same thing: we're going to need help. So basically ODOT was saying, well, if we get the people, then will you use the people? And they said, in essence, yes. And like Matt said, we've been working with AGC all along. So we looked at how can we do this on a statewide basis. Again, I mentioned the word change. This is a different approach for ODOT. There's an old expression, I'm sure you've heard it, you know, how do you eat an elephant? Well, one little bite at a time. So we decided to take the state, and the ODOT has five highway regions 1 through 5, and to give you an example, there's the Portland metro area, that's region 1, that consists of Clackamas, Columbia, Hood River, and so on. Region 2, Benton, Clatsop, Lane, Lincoln counties. Region 3 is Coos, Kerry, Douglas, Josephine, and Jackson. Region 4 is Crooks, Deschutes, and several others, and region 5 is Baker, Grant, and Umatilla. So we decided to take those existing regions and say, now, how can we address the workforce issues at those individual levels? So we established what was called workforce development alliances. And those alliances, as Matt said a few moments ago, they were comprised or are comprised of local governments, the community-based organizations, the one-stop employment type organizations that are already in existence in these regions. They've been doing this type of thing for many, many years, because ODOT has been saying every step of the way, we don't know how to do this by ourselves, so we need to partner with you all and everyone out here to lend your expertise. So the purpose of each one of these alliances is to perform outreach in terms of getting recruits, to have recruitment type drives, to assess the individuals as they are coming into the pipeline, to provide supportive services. Director Garrett mentioned PCC Skills Center a few moments ago. We entered into an intergovernment agreement with them to provide skills and assessment of individuals as they come through relative to their geographic area. And also training. We've entered into contracts with drug testing facilities because the contracting communities gave us a profile of what was a qualified laborer to them or labor person to them. So working along those guidelines, we bring people into the pipeline, progress them through. If we find there's a stumbling block or there's a hiccup in the path, we then send that person back again to get the necessary remedial help. If their math skills are low, their reading skills are low, we send them back so they can get training, then they come right back into the pipeline again with the ultimate goal to get them into that qualified labor pool, which will then be drawn upon by the contracting community. Working along with AGC, as I said before, we have apprenticeship requirements in our contracts based on geographic location, availability of workforce, and so on. So what we agreed to do along with AGC is over an incremental time frame, we would start with 5% and then work our way up to 20%, gradually monitoring the contractor performance and monitoring how many people we've had to get into the pipeline and then gradually shift up. This way, we would be gradually getting people and apprentices into the pipeline, into work, getting them trained, and so on. These regional alliances were indeed kicked off, and we have all four out of five alliances up and running right now. The last Alliance, which is in Region 4, will be kicked off late February, early March in that time frame. Each alliance, as it is indeed established, it is in line with the construction, anticipated construction date for the projects in that geographic area. So we don't run out and start up an alliance prematurely. We try to do it staged. So they did not go in a numerical order, obviously, because the program wasn't laid out that way. So while Region 1 happened to be first, we then jumped to Region 5, and then we did Region 3, and then Region 2, and then Region 5 will be the very last one. Yes, sir.
Quick question, Madam Chair.
Yes, sorry.
Thank you. The 20%, is that a statewide goal, or is that a goal for each region?
Madam Chair and committee members, that is a statewide goal.
Thank you.
Okay.
No one else here? Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. So the region, each regional alliance is indeed up and running, and we are, of course, monitoring the results, and we will keep on moving forward as the construction season pans out. That pretty much covers the workforce dimension of this economic stimulus equation. But there's another dimension to that equation, and that's the small business that Director Garrett referred to.
Madam Chair, before we move on to small business, could I ask a question about the workforce? Thank you. It seems to me in learning about the workforce over the years that I've been in the legislature that only a small percentage of teenagers will go on to go to college. What is it, 25-30%? And so we need training for the majority of the students in high school that will not be going on to college. So I appreciate what you're doing. My thought is that it needs to start at an early age, especially females and minorities, that they need to see this as a viable occupation for them, a viable profession. So is there anything being done at the high school level or even middle school level?
Thank you. Yes, Madam Chairman and committee members. Indeed, I'm so glad to hear you ask that question. I could give you a whole list of the things that we're into, but we have indeed addressed that. As we speak, I have folks on my staff that have been working with McKay High School, as an example, for starters. We will be working with them to develop a construction certificate program so that when a high school student graduates high school, they have a choice of either going with the traditional high school diploma with a construction certificate or both or whichever. We've spoken with a number of parents and they've said exactly that. College is indeed not for everyone, and some parents have said, my first two children successfully made it through with degrees, but my last one, well, we need something else. So you're 100% correct, and we're looking to partner with high schools. We've had several conversations with them. We're working with the Oregon Women in Trades, Connie Ashbrook's organization. I'm trying to work out an agreement with them so I can fund some of the things that they wish to do over there also. So yes, we're indeed looking in that direction. We're trying to get ahead of the curve. We realize that if, like other countries in the world, if we can get to the youngsters first and gear them in this direction, those that might fit the mold, that is the time to do it, not wait until they've become teenagers and young adults.
Follow up? Yes. I understand that women in the trades, I used to be a member of the Women's Commission, that women in trades, that number is declining rather than increasing. I don't know how to address that, and I'm hoping that somebody does know how to address that, because these are well-paying jobs. Mm-hmm. And if women don't see this as a viable alternative, or young women, mm-hmm. then very often they're stuck doing jobs that are dead-end jobs rather than aspiring to do something where they can make a family wage job.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Can I ask if it might be possible for you to provide information on how we can contact folks in our region, who in our region we should talk to? I'm in Region 3 in Jackson County, and I would just like to be able to get an update on where we are in our region.
Sure.
And I can see from the timeline that it's been moving pretty aggressively. I'd just like to see where we are.
Sure. Madam Chair, committee members, yes, I have a staff member that literally lives and works in each of the five regions. The staff person down there would be a Marie Wright, and I can certainly supply that phone number to you before I leave here.
I appreciate it.
Like. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else? All right. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Moving on to to the next part of this equation, as I said, we realize that with the future demands that we need to grow the small business opportunities. And again, I'm so full of adages here, but the old adage, if someone is hungry, to give them a fish, well, we need to teach them how to fish. So we started moving forward thinking here that we need to do more than just find opportunities for small businesses, but how can we develop them so that once they're on a job and then that job ends, that they will indeed be a viable business to compete into the future. So we met with several folks in the contracting community and the small business community, as well as those of us in ODOT, and we said that, well, if the contracting community is telling us that they're willing to hire small business and they're really looking for a small business, and if the small businesses are saying that they want opportunities, then what's preventing them from getting together? What are the barriers? What are the barriers, and then what can we do to remove those barriers? What can we do to resolve the situation? So as Director Garrett said, in August of 2006, we had our first kickoff meeting of the Small Business Initiative meeting, and we had AGC there, representatives of the small business community. We had the heads of the five local chambers of commerce, and we set the tone for what we'd like to do here, that we'd like to form sort of a triumvirate, if you will, a partnership between the three groups, ODOT, small business, and contracting community. Let's meet and get together and determine just what needs to be done. What can we do to increase opportunities? And we were looking in two areas. Before I get to what came out of the Small Business Initiative, we need to kind of understand the differences between the DBE program and the Emerging Small Business Program. So the DBE program stands for Disadvantaged Business Enterprise, and that program is regulated by the U.S. Department of Transportation, and it requires certain criteria, and one being that 51% at least ownership be to a woman or to minorities. And the objective of the DBE program is to ensure that ODOT complies with DBE laws and requirements. It ensures that DBEs can compete fairly for USDOT funded contracts, ensure that only eligible firms participate as DBEs, and to help develop firms to compete successfully in the marketplace outside of the DBE program later on. So that's the definition of the DBE program. On the emerging small business side, again, the definition is slightly different. That's state managed, and it's basically in two tiers. They have to have a principal place of business in Oregon, for one. They have to have an average annual gross income receipts over the past 3 years in either of two tiers. Tier one is not exceeding $1.5 million for construction firms and $600,000 for non-construction firms, or tier two, not exceeding $3 million for construction firms and $1 million for non-construction. They must have fewer than 20 employees for tier one and not more than 30 employees for tier two. The 2005 Oregon legislator also extended the time that a firm may participate in the ESB program to a maximum of 12 years. That was to allow a small firm to grow during that time frame. So I just wanted to give you a little feel for the difference between the two business entities, because it impacts how we move forward. Now, getting back to teaching the people how to fish as opposed to just feeding them, economic stimulus task was how can that be done and what can be done. So again, the program was launched in 2006, and we put the initiative into two categories. What can we do with professional services, and what can we do with those that are in construction? We came up with an innovative way of contracting here on the professional services side, that for contracts under $75,000, we could pre-qualify them. And the only conditions was that they were not acting as primes on existing contracts with ODOTs. So it's kind of leveled the playing field so they could compete with like capacities, if you will. The first month, we launched a pilot program in the month of October. The first few weeks of that, we had well over 200 applicants that applied for that process. Now OPO and ODOT, procurement and ODOT, we're looking at those applications, and we're looking to make some awards to some contracts in this before this month is out, January of 2007. So we found an overwhelming response to that particular program. On the construction side, we're continuing to identify the barriers. We continue the meetings with small business, and we've prioritized some of the things, the issues that we can fix within ODOT. We're just looking at fixing those things that require a little more involvement with other state agencies. We're meeting with the necessary people. One of the things that I heard repeatedly was that we just don't know where to find opportunities. I mean, I do fencing, and I don't know where to look. So on my website, I've put
can
all
I
of this.
Can I interrupt just a second?
Sure.
I have a question.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
That's
all right. Thank you, Madam Chair. In the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department budget, there's an entity that's funded called GCAP, Government Contracting Assistance Program, and it's an entity that provides technical assistance to folks who are looking to contract with the Oregon Department of Transportation along with other folks. How's your relationship been with GCAP?
We work with them.
Good.
We work with them, exactly. Yes, indeed. We've had a contract with them, I think, as a matter of fact, well before I started within the Office of Civil Rights there. So, yes, we are working with them.
Okay. I just add, Madam Chair, that's a wonderful, wonderful resource.
Absolutely.
And an opportunity for you folks to bridge between what you're going on and the small business owner, because they're out there in the fields.
Yes.
And they are your biggest advocates, too. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Sorry.
That's quite all right. So in moving forward, like I said, we are continuing with meetings there, and as we identify what the issues are, we're looking for solutions to those problems, outreach, and so on. As far as performance is concerned here, just to give you some really quick numbers here, in 2003, the total dollars awarded to contracts was $426,091. As of June of 2006, the total number of contracts for DB and ESB combined is $7,118,366. Okay, so we've seen some movements. We've seen some movements, and we're continuing to move forward. We've seen movements in the ethnic groups that have received contracts also from 2003, where it was zero, up to almost $500,000 through 2006. So as far as next steps are concerned, on the workforce side, we will continue the alliances, of course, moving forward and monitoring that and tweaking as we see the need and going forward. On the small business initiative side, we will continue the small contracting effort for the professional services and looking at ways to develop similar type approaches to contracting on the construction side. In summary, I guess I could just say that in the final analysis, ODOT was presented a challenge. We've risen and met that challenge with enthusiasm and results. The agency is successfully placing applicants in the qualified labor pool. It has established outreach programs in the communities, including web resources and a toll-free number even to expedite enrollment. And it is also responding to the small business community in many positive and tangible ways. We look forward to continuing building upon these successes into the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. It's not really a question. It's a comment. I really appreciate your presentation today, gentlemen. And Matt, especially I want to commend you for putting the Office of Civil Rights into your office. I think that is a terrific idea. And some years ago, the state awarded contracts to out-of-state contractors, and it really hit the fan here in Oregon. It was before your tenure, Matt, I know. But I think we've been really careful since then to make sure that when these contracts go out, that they go out to Oregonians. And I'm so delighted to see that you're looking at underemployed people who can make a career out of these positions. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to add to the accolades. Colleagues, these folks do a very, very good job in their outreach, particularly to small business owners. And I need to put on the record, I have tremendous conflicts of interest here in that I work with many entities that provide technical assistance, and some of those entities receive funding from the Department of Transportation. But what I do want to share with you is, in order to create success and ensure that all Oregonians have an opportunity to do business with the state, it takes technical assistance. And I would strongly encourage you folks to continue to work with those entities that provide that technical assistance, because they're your mouthpiece.
Absolutely.
Folks come in off of Main Street, they walk into your Small Business Development Center, they walk into your GCAP offices, and they say, help me. And so I would strongly encourage you folks to continue to work with them. They're great advocates for you.
Okay.
So,
any other questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the informational hearing, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2176.
Madam Chair, members, HB 2176 removes the state health officer from the obligation to determine medical eligibility to safely operate a motor vehicle. It establishes that responsibility with the Department of Transportation's medical determination officer to certify medical eligibility to operate a motor vehicle by a person with specified impairments. It allows the department to employ or enter into an agreement with any qualified physician, nurse practitioner, or physician assistant as determined by rule to perform the duties assigned to the medical determination officer. We have a no revenue impact statement. We're still waiting for the fiscal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to call up Dr. Grant Higginson and Jack Evans, if you come up together.
I'm going to start off.
Okay.
Good afternoon. Chair Byer and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I am the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning with the Public Health Division within the Department of Human Services. And the reason that I'm here today in front of the Transportation Committee is because my office, one of the responsibilities that we have is to do medical reviews upon request by the Department of Motor Vehicles on selected cases. We've been working with the ODOT and DMV for the last several months on this idea of moving the responsibility for these reviews to DMV from the Department of Human Services, and we've come to agreement that we think this is a good idea, and we are in support of this bill. There's a number of reasons why people should be restricted from having a driver's license if they are not able to safely operate a motor vehicle. And while it's relatively rare, there are some cases where a person has a physical or a mental issue that does affect their ability to safely drive a motor vehicle. And so since the 1940s, the state public health agency has had the responsibility of doing reviews for the Department of Motor Vehicles when the department believes there is an individual who may be affected by a medical condition that impacts on their ability to safely operate a vehicle. Now, while we've had this for a long time, we've actually for a long time not really felt this was a good fit for public health. And for the last 20 years since the 1980s, we've said, you know, this kind of expertise is really something that we as public health professionals don't have. And so in essence, for the last 20 years, we've been contracting this responsibility with physicians in another part of the department who do have that expertise and medical eligibility determination. But it's become even more clear to us over the last few years that there's some really good reasons, I think, to move this program from Department of Human Services Public Health over to ODOT. I think that you're probably well aware there have been a number of changes in how we look at the ability of a person to drive when it comes to medical issues and moving away from a diagnosis classification and into a functional classification. There have been a lot of changes in the forms and the way the system works. There's been a lot more review work that's being done now by the office over in Department of Motor Vehicles to determine whether a case even needs to come to us. And there's been a whole lot more in the way of outreach and education and training to the healthcare community. For all of these reasons, I just think it makes a whole lot more sense to have a physician be a part of that Department of Motor Vehicles teams that's running this program rather than have it be fragmented in another part of state government. In addition to improving, I believe, the quality of the service that's being provided, I think that there will be some real streamlining as well so that cases will be dealt with quicker and less costly. And then the other thing I would like to add is that there are a few handful of amendments that we will be working with legislative council on to get put into the bill, and those are not available today. Four of the five really, I think, are very minor housekeeping issues. One of them, however, does make it clear that a person is entitled to a contested case hearing versus an administrative review if there is a decision that the individual does not agree with, and we are certainly in support of making sure there's due process in the system. And then the final thing I will add is that just before the hearing, the lobbyists from the Oregon Medical Association asked if they could have an amendment put in that, in addition, talking about a qualified provider, and this would be either a physician, nurse practitioner, or a physician assistant who could do these reviews, that person should also hold an unrestricted license in the state of Oregon, and that, again, is something that would be easy for us to support. So with that, I'll close and be happy to answer any questions, or we could turn it over to Mr. Doyle.
Any questions here? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Higginson, thank you very much for this testimony, and we look forward to the amendments, including the one talking about qualified medical practitioners. You'd mentioned that in fact, the department was arranging for the services to be provided by physicians within the department who have this expertise. Is that within your department presently?
Chair Byron, Representative Butler, yes, that is correct. It's in our developmental disabilities determination department, which is actually a different part of the department than public health.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you very much. So, Dr. Higginson, do we anticipate that the Department of Transportation will just continue to basically contract with your department with these physicians that are already in place?
Chair Byron, Representative Butler, no, we don't. In fact, we're unsatisfied with the situation as it stands right now. We're in the process of hiring a part-time physician who would do this work. And my anticipation is that when this moves to the Department of Motor Vehicles, that they would do a similar thing.
Thank you, Madam. I look forward to hearing Jack's testimony, which could clear that up to make sure that they're amenable to that transition of personnel. Madam Chair,
any
thank
other
you
questions?
Very much.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation. I think Dr. Higginson has pretty much covered everything. Our department has been working with DHS on this concept for a while, making sure that we think it'll work out fine, and we're feeling positive about this. We've been contracting with DHS for this these services for years and years, and what this would do would be to provide that function out of ODOT. There are a number of benefits, some of which Dr. Higginson alluded to. Having an on-staff physician would provide better security and confidentiality of medical records and client records. There'd be access to medical expertise for advice and analysis related to general program management here. And the medical eligibility licensing standards and review criteria, we'd be able to assure that these are based on current medical standards. So there's some additional benefits. These physicians look at a couple of our programs, specifically the at-risk driver program, which is designed to take people that are considered to be unsafe off the road, and also the interstate medical waiver for the commercial driver's license program. We don't see any conflict moving this position into ODOT. There'll be a separation between the medical determination process and the administrative sanctions process so that we're not having a situation where the fox is watching the hen house, if you will. There are a number of other state agencies that are doing this in a number of other states, Maryland, Oklahoma, and North Carolina, whose DMVs are employing on-staff physicians in similar functions. But most importantly, Dr. Higginson alluded to the contested case hearing, which is an important part. If someone does have a question, they can fall back on a contested case hearing, and that'll be heard by an impartial administrative law judge outside of the department. So we think that provides adequate due process. Finally, there's going to be no impact on customers or medical personnel that make referrals and reports to DMV. That'll be the same process. And it'll essentially be a wash financially. We're paying for this service now, and we'll be taking over the position. And we intend to hire a half-time position. And in response to Representative Butler's question, as I understand it, yes, we won't have a problem taking that position in. What we'll need to make sure is that we have adequate position authority down the road, but we have the funding for it, and we're comfortable that we'll be able to make that transition very smoothly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jack, I appreciate your statement and comment. Thank you very much. And of course that position authority and the transfer of the budgets will all be taken care of down the bowels of the building somewhere in the Ways and Means process. So I'm sure that you'll be able to work that out, and I appreciate that explanation that we will still have the level of competence and the access to professional people, same as we have now, but more centrally located within the Department of Transportation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Butler.
Thanks, Madam Chair. It's just a comment. It's rare in my experience to have DHS come to us and ask us to cut a service. So I'm kind of a little stunned, but I'm willing to take this under advisement.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and seeing no other, unless there's other testimony out there, I'm going to close the public hearing and we'll wait to see the amendments. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2272. Judith, explain the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2272 adds compliance with low emission standards as a requirement for registration of motor vehicles beginning with model year 2009. It directs the Department of Transportation to promulgate rules defining what constitutes compliance with low emission motor vehicle standards and which new motor vehicles are exempt from the requirement. It requires the rules to be consistent with relevant Environmental Quality Commission standards, and it does put in a definition of a new motor vehicle. I have also provided the current statutory exemptions. You'll see the ORS 815300. You'll see the current exemptions from the requirement for vehicles to be equipped with pollution control systems. We have received a no revenue impact statement and, again, are still waiting for the fiscal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, Al Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing Catrala, which is a car rental and leasing association of Oregon. We are neutral on the bill, but we would like to focus on sections 8A and B of the bill in relation to the rules which will be developed for proof of compliance and the rule which will be developed for exemption from the requirements of this law. Our comptrollers have emailed me saying that we register thousands of cars many months in advance for the coming year, and we would like to be part of the rulemaking process so that for our companies the proof of registration would be seamless. It would be continuous, almost like what we're doing now. And also, we are ordering new model year vehicles months prior to the vehicles being available for sale. And so we would like to be in the forefront of seeing what their exemption list is so that we know what vehicles we have to take through this process. It's more of an administrative concerns that we have, and want to go on record as saying that we want to work with ODOT in developing the rules specifically so that they hear our concerns.
Thank you.
That's basically it.
Okay. Any questions? Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did, in meeting with the ODOT, I asked them about the issue of rental car companies and fleets and those kinds of things from out of state. It's my understanding that they are coming up with the answers. And, well, I don't know that there's a way that we can include rental car companies in the rulemaking process. Certainly it's my understanding that they will be included and noticed for any rulemaking and other administrative procedures. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Tom Gallagher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Tom Gallagher for making my first appearance on behalf of the Oregon Automobile Dealers Association. For many of you that worked with us over the past couple of years on these emission rules and laws, we thank you. But they're in place now, and we support this bill wholeheartedly, and we think that as we go forward, closing this loophole so that out-of-state dealers can't sell cars under 75,000 miles into the state that don't meet our emission limitations makes a lot of sense. And we've been in communication with both the Department of Motor Vehicles and with DEQ and assured them that we think this is a very good amendment to the law.
Thank you. Questions?
Madam Chair, for the record, I think Tom meant 7,500 miles as opposed to 75,000.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, no, that was offering an amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, next, Andy Ginsburg and Jack Evans come up together.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Andy Ginsburg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, and I'm here to provide a little bit of background on the clean car rules that's behind this bill and our support for House Bill 2272. Last June, the Environmental Quality Commission adopted the clean cars rule, and it does require vehicles that are of the 2009 and newer model years to meet California standards. We joined 10 other states in doing that, including Washington to the north and, of course, California, which established standards to the south. And the purpose of the rule is to reduce the carbon dioxide emissions from motor vehicles that contribute to global warming. We also get significant reductions in other types of emissions that contribute to smog and toxic air pollutants. Now we're looking towards implementing the program, and implementation is coming upon us quickly because even though we're talking about the 2009 model year, for some manufacturers that begins as early as January 2008. So this is coming this biennium. We're already doing outreach and working with the manufacturers, and soon we'll be working with the dealers and setting up our processes. In implementing the bill, the requirements, we have three key things in mind. One is, of course, we want the cars to meet the standards so the air will be clean. But just as important, we want to make sure that we have a level playing field for Oregon dealers. As Tom Gallagher mentioned, we don't want to have out-of-state dealers, for example, from Idaho selling a vehicle that's non-compliant for less money and luring Oregonians into buying a vehicle that really can't be legally sold in Oregon, and then bring it into state and undercutting Oregon dealers. So making sure we have a level playing field is very important, as is protecting consumers. In most of the other states, the other 10 states that have this program, the primary form of implementation is through the registration process. It's very simple. A new car has a manufacturer's statement of origin, and it says clearly on it whether the car meets California standards or not. And this bill would give DMV the authority to take a look at that and only register cars that are California certified. If a consumer brings a car that's not California certified, and the registration would be denied, that the consumer would go back to the dealer, return the car, get one that does comply, and after one or two times of that happening, dealers are unlikely to continue trying to sell non-compliant cars in Oregon. The question was asked a little while ago about rental car companies, and we do have a number of exemptions in the law. I'd be happy to go through them with you. But in particular, because rental car companies tend to buy vehicles for their entire fleet. They may buy vehicles in Oregon that are intended to be used outside of Oregon. Those types of things are exempt. Used vehicles are exempt. Military vehicles are exempt. And I can go through the rest of them if you'd like. So in summary, we think that the registration process is the most efficient way to implement this program. And we support the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How come we can't call it the Oregon standard? Why does it have to be the California standard? I want an amendment.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do call it the Oregon Low Emission Vehicle Program.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the fact that federal vehicles or military vehicles may have different standards. What of the mail carriers? There's a significant fleet of mail carriers in the state of Oregon through the U.S. Postal Service. I'd just like to know a little bit about what kind of other implementing language you've got for other federal vehicles that otherwise will be still milling around Oregon.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, there's no specific provision for other than the military vehicles. There's no provision for federal vehicles being exempt. We do have specific provisions for emergency vehicles that may be a special type of vehicle and that can't otherwise comply. And we've got provisions for example, if you were to inherit a vehicle from someone out of state that had a non-compliant vehicle, that's exempt. If through divorce a vehicle ended up in Oregon, that would be okay. If you are an active duty military personnel and you purchase a vehicle while you're assigned out of state, you can bring that car back. So we tried to anticipate all those types of situations, and we used the same exemptions that are used in most of the other states and actually a few more than Washington had.
Madam Chair, I still have just a number of concerns about these kinds of things. And Madam Chair, I live on a border. I mean, from many places in the town where I live, you can hit a golf ball and it'll end up on the Idaho side. My concern, and in some places you don't even have to cross a bridge. I mean, you can walk across the street or you can walk through the field and end up in the state of Idaho. So my concern is that we do have a pretty clear delineation. I also have a concern that how many times will it be that folks will look in an Oregon dealership in Mount Hare County and find the car for $1,000 more than they will find it right across the river in Idaho and not understand. So I'd like to know what both the DEQ as well as the Department of Transportation intends to do with regard to consumer outreach in the state of Oregon, and particularly in my district, what attempts they're going to have to make sure that people understand that you cannot cross that river, but what you're going to end up with an automobile that's going to cost you $1,000 more and an after factory add-on.
Thank you.
Can we ask if there's a response from DEQ or ODOT?
Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, we will be having extensive outreach to dealers and consumers. Idaho dealers will be able to get compliant cars, so they will be able to sell cars to Oregon, but they will just have to be California certified or Oregon low emission vehicle certified.
Since we haven't heard from Jack yet, we'll go ahead and let him testify.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Jack Evans of the Department of Transportation, and I'm here to speak, of course, in favor of House Bill 2272, which is our bill. Our principal concern in this bill is to level the playing field for Oregon dealers. We're certainly interested in not having them at a competitive disadvantage. Hence, we'd like to get the authority that we do not have now, which is the ability to deny new vehicle registration based on these emission standards. So that's why the statutory change is necessary. I think most of it, Andy has covered the bulk of of what I was going to talk about. I'll just say the process, if someone comes to DMV to register a new vehicle, if they have an out-of-state title, DMV will go in and look at the VIN number and compare it, and we'll do an under-the-hood inspection to make sure that sticker is there that shows the emission standards. And then, as Andy said, that if it's a new car that hasn't been titled, they'll look at the MCO with all the information on it. As far as a outreach plan, that's a really excellent idea, and that's something that we'll want to work hand in hand with DAEQ on to make sure that people are aware of it, and importantly, they're aware of some of the consequences of trying to get around this, because I believe it's rather expensive to retrofit a vehicle. And people do need to know this up front. So with that, I think Andy has covered a lot of what I was going to say, so I will open it up for any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. Question. Representative
Gilman. Jack, you indicated when you talked to me about this bill in the office that somebody that lives in Oregon City, for instance, drives to Minnesota. Car breaks down. They buy a new car and bring it back to Oregon, that would be all right. I don't see anything like this in the law that I'm looking at. How are we going to implement that?
Chair, by Representative Gilman, that part of the law talks to the developing that in rule, mm-hmm. and the rule is to be based upon the DEQ rules. So, and that particular exemption is within the DEQ rules, so we'll be adopting that. And that is in that group of exemptions that Andy was alluding to that includes the military vehicles and those types of things.
Representative Smith.
So what if my car breaks down in Boise?
Chair Beyer, Representative Smith, unless somebody then steals it from you and you purchase a new car, I think you're out of luck.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we go through all these kind of hoops, and I told Jack when he came and visited me about this piece of legislation that I'm concerned that whenever you get to a group of farmers and other agricultural people and tell them what the rule is, they immediately start to scratch their head and saying, okay, now how can I get around that rule? As I understand it, there is nothing within this particular statute that we're proposing to pass in this bill which would preclude Oregonians who have decided to do a wintertime tour from sometime in the early fall. There would be nothing that would preclude them from establishing a relationship with a Montana dealership where there are no sales taxes, going to Montana, trading in their automobile for a new 2010 automobile without these emission standards, and then beginning their fall-time tour, crossing the United States and going up through the Northeast and then down to Florida and touring Florida in the South, coming up along through Texas and then California and eventually returning to Oregon, at which time that they would go ahead and register the automobile and it would have 7,501 miles on it. That's why I wanted to make the point that Jack Elkins, the 75,000 wasn't correct. It's 7,501. And so at that particular point, there would be nothing that would preclude those folks from basically saving an extra $1,000. There's another issue, too, and that is there's probably 10 to 15,000 Oregonians every licensing period that are buying their automobiles in Europe. Tell me how we are going to resolve that issue. Buying their automobiles, taking delivery on them of them in Europe, doing their vacation in Europe, and then having them dropped off of the boat here without any retrofit. Are we going to have to retrofit those here? What's the status?
Chair, Fire Representative Butler, the First of all, to the second part of your question, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency requires that vehicles that are imported into the U.S. meet U.S. standards, and California does as well. So a vehicle that would be imported to the U.S. would be built to be sold in the U.S., and if it's not, it wouldn't be complying with the law and would be in violation.
Madam Chair, if I may, we've only been told that there's right now a maximum of 10 states. So really, this meets 40 state requirements, so it is built to U.S. standards, the automobiles in Europe.
That's correct, Madam Chair, Representative Butler, but could not be sold for use in any of those 10 states that have opted into to the California standards. I'm sorry, can you repeat the first part of your question?
Well, really, to that point, again, if I may, Madam Chair, my concern is that will those folks now no longer be able to do what they have done, take their vacation every 3 or 4 years to Europe to pick up their automobiles, to enjoy the use of it whilst they are in Europe, or will they have to make arrangements with an organ, and usually those are delivered by Oregon automobile dealers is what happens. They're actually part of their fleet. My assumption is that they will be built as if they were to be delivered to that new Oregon dealership in Oregon. And if that's the case, that's fine. The second part of my question was, what precludes Oregonians from going on vacation after establishing a relationship with a Montana dealership? No sales tax. Actually, the largest car dealer in the United States is in Montana, incidentally. Establishing a very excellent relationship with those folks up there, delivering their used car there, picking up their new car, driving at 7,501 miles, and showing back up to Oregon to register it.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, first of all, once the car does hit 7,500 miles, then it's not considered a new car, so it could be registered in Oregon, just like any other used car, even if it didn't meet the California standards, if it met the EPA standards. I don't think the scenario you're describing is different than the situation today if someone wanted to go to Montana and buy a car, but I think your concern is that if the price of a new car in Oregon is higher because of the standards, they might have more of an incentive. And to that point, the Oregon Low Emission Vehicle Program actually is going to save consumers money on a net basis because these vehicles will be so much more fuel efficient in order to meet the CO2 standards that the savings in fuel will more than offsets the initial increase in cost in vehicles, which is not that great. It's California estimates it to be in the order, once this program is fully phased in about 2013, in the order of about $1,000 more per vehicle, and then a huge savings in fuel economy. So that will be part of our outreach program to make sure consumers are aware of the fuel economy savings and benefits. But I don't think it would be worth anyone's while to make that trip to Montana just for the purpose of buying a car. But certainly if they're there and that's their normal practice to buy a vehicle on their trip, they'd be able to do that.
Madam Chair, the reason that I'm having that discussion is that these rules were put into place to try and protect Oregon dealers in that process. And I'm just concerned that maybe they don't really protect Oregon dealers for those folks who would like to just, and I appreciate the fact that there might be savings down the road in 8 or 10 years for those folks when all of the gasoline and all of the blended fuels are all blended and are all uniformly efficient throughout all delivery systems in the United States and particularly along the West Coast. My concern is, and I've seen other folks here on this committee probably deal regularly with consumers where you look at the down payment on the original price, and the original price is $1,000 less, and the down payment is commensurately less, and you say, wait a minute, why am I worried about fuel prices in 2015? And the consumption that I'll have, efficiency of consumption in 2015 when the wheels are all going to be gone from this piece of equipment. So I was just anxious about to make sure that we are, in fact, protecting Oregon dealers through this piece of legislation. I appreciate the comments that Mr. Ginsburg makes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Butler. Just to respond to Representative Butler's remarks, I there are some very wealthy individuals in my district, but I just don't know of very many that could actually afford to take the time to every year or when they want to buy a new car to go to Montana and then spend the time to drive 7,500 miles back to rest the car. It's not something in my life experience. I'm having a hard time relating to that.
I tell you what, once you see the Northeast in the fall, number one, you'll say, I wish that Oregon could learn from, Oregon Tourism could learn how they do tourism. And number two, you'll say, this is something I really want to come back and do again. So, but don't buy a car in Montana.
Take care of that. I promise I will.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions here? Okay, seeing none, thank you, gentlemen. I think at this point I'm going to close the public hearing and not open a work session, and we'll see if anybody can get more comfortable with it. But I think we need to look at a way to protect Oregon dealers, and if we can't, you know, come up with it, we'll just probably end up going with it. So if you have suggestions.
I can't believe it's going to be a very large population of people who would be doing this.
Yes, I agree. So I close the public hearing and thank everybody for coming. Oh, yes. Sorry. Get ahead of myself. Okay, I'm going to open a work session on introduction of committee bills. So Judith, explain it.
Madam Chair, members, you have at your seat at the dais LC 2146 would exempt a person from the offense of an unlawful use of metal objects on tires if the person, in fact, uses tires with retractable studs during those allowed specified periods. It allows a tire dealer to sell tires equipped with non-lightweight studs, again, if those studs are retractable. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I move LC 2146 be introduced as a committee bill.
Thank you. Representative Butler moves LC draft 2146 to be introduced as a committee bill. Discussion?
Madam Chair,
okay.
I wish that we'd... Thank you. Thank you. I wish that we'd had some discussion on this or... some presentation. Did I miss something? Did this happen during the interim?
No.
We will have discussion.
We will.
The motion is on the floor. It's time for discussion now.
Yes.
Right, but I guess whoever is proposing this, I would assume we would have had someone proposing.
Well, this is just for introduction as a committee bill.
Okay.
And if you have questions or if you you want to talk about it, we can do that. That's what we're doing right now.
Okay. I just feel like I need more information about this. How many cars are we talking about? How many tires? How long has this been in service? How effective are these? Do they really retract, et cetera? I mean, I feel uncomfortable voting for a committee bill when I have no information about this.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. And there is... a company that has started making them. It's a new product. And what this bill is supposed to do is just change it, the statute, so that if a person buys a set of these tires, they can keep them on their car past the deadline because they're retractable. They won't be damaging the road, and it's just to allow that, although I will tell you that I would think with a product like this, it could be a little expensive, and I'm not sure how many people are going to want to drive them all year round anyway. It's a new product, and I'm not sure that anyone is driving them yet. I think most of us were distributed a CD that kind of explained the product a little bit. But this is just to introduce it as a committee bill, and then if everybody's comfortable with it, we'll have a public hearing and we can explore it.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would have to agree with Representative Tomei. I know in terms of process we're up against a deadline, but it would be good to give advance notice when we are going to consider a committee bill to move forward. I did receive a presentation, and obviously you didn't, Representative Tomei, from a representative. I think it's a wonderful product, and it's going to be very, very, better when they can get a mass produced, it'll be very helpful. People in my district who kind of fight that limit of when it gets shut off. But again, in terms of process, I do understand what Representative Tomei is saying. Right. Would love to get advance notice when possible.
Right. Further discussion. I just want to echo what Representative Buckley has just indicated. There, the time that snow tires go on in the fall, when they can legally show up in the fall, to the time that they must come off in the spring, there are days immediately before and after in certain parts of Oregon where you really can't say it must stop snowing by April 15th, or it cannot start snowing by November, before November 1st. And so there will be times, and I envision, and I agree fully with the chair, that it would be far too expensive to run these kinds of tires on a year-round basis. However, that said, these folks will put those tires on maybe a month before the regular snow tire season. They will not fight the snow tire crowd the day of the first snow or on November 1st, and they will not fight the snow tire crowd getting them off by the April 15th date. They will actually, or April 1st, I guess, they'll actually have some lead time before and after without the studs being present until the day of. And I understand it's an adjustment on the tire itself that you make on all four tires. The studs then become evident and physically present, and then they will be legal on that day. It's not something that you have to go through the installation process at that point. So it sounded like a good product.
Any other comments?
Call for question.
Okay. Those of the opinion that LC Draft 2146 should be introduced as a committee bill will vote aye, and those opposed, no. And the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative
aye. Motion carries, and LC Draft 2146 will be introduced as a committee bill. Thank you, and I close the committee today.